This is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand. In a few minutes, we'll hear about the stirring effects of inaudible sounds. But first, in Texas, politicians are still debating last week's announcement by Texas A&M University that it is abolishing legacy admissions. These give preference to the relatives of past graduates. Pressure to scrap them has increased as colleges ended affirmative action policies and faced calls to scrap other non-academic selection criteria. Day to Day's Karen Grigsby Bates discussed the issue earlier with reporter James Fallows of the Atlantic Monthly.
Jim Fallows, briefly define for us what legacy admissions are and why they exist.
Well, there's a formal and an informal version. The formal version has just come under scrutiny at Texas A&M, where on their 100-point formula for deciding whether to admit students to the college, they added 4 points out of the 100 for people who were the direct children of graduates of Texas A&M. The informal system, which is probably, it's more like a thumb on the scale. Most highly selective colleges, sort of the Ivy League, the little Ivies, those where there's a supply-demand imbalance, they will all claim that being an alumni child never makes the conclusive difference in getting in, but they'll call it a tie-breaking factor. The high road reason to explain why these exist is to have a sense of continuity, the idea that a certain family has gone to a certain college for generation after generation. I think in addition to whatever reality is in that claim, there also is a low road practicality that alumni tend to be more generous in their donations if they think that their children have a head start, a better chance of getting in.
Mm-hmm. President Bush is probably the best-known former legacy admission at the moment. He went to Yale, as did his father and his grandfather, and he missed his grades weren't what got him there. Maybe this is one of many things that is considered when admissions are being contemplated.
Sure, and President Bush himself is a very interesting case because he was in the college class of 1968, and that was really the last class at Yale where the alumni preference and the East Coast prep school preference was as heavy as it had been up to that time. And there's been a whole lot of academic writing about the class of 68 at Yale as being this watershed. 69, 70, and onward, Yale, and by implication, a lot of other selective institutions became much more consciously meritocratic, nationwide, racial diversity conscious, eventually gender conscious in their admissions. So that's a phase shift.
Some people have referred to legacy admission policies as affirmative action for rich people or affirmative action for white people. How accurate an assessment do you find that?
Well, that certainly has been its effect over the years. And again, the Texas A&M case illustrates it in a particularly stark way. A&M was essentially whites only until about 40 years ago, until the early 60s when it began to integrate. And so just by definition, any kind of systematic preference for past graduates is going to have a bias against non-white applicants because they weren't there. It's also a sort of rhetorical or political counterpoint to affirmative action on class or racial lines, because whenever you can have a statistic saying that so many minority students got into a college and their grades were lower than the mean for that class, then you can answer back and say, well, so many alumni children got in and their average was lower too. So it has that kind of counterweight factor.
Let's say we actually got people to agree to drop legacy admissions. Would everyone have to agree to do it concurrently in order to make it work?
Yes and no. There's a very interesting, in reforming all of these admissions practices, there's an interesting complication of antitrust law, because universities, unlike baseball, don't have an antitrust exemption, so they're not really allowed to collude, and there'd be somebody who would be disadvantaged. Chauncey Tidwell V would be disadvantaged if they got rid of this, and he could well sue. So they'd have to work out these antitrust implications. On the other hand, universities, more than almost any other part of American life, really are in a hierarchical situation. You have a couple of very snooty ones at the top, and then you have 10 or 15 after that, and there is a ripple effect. If you got the most selective and influential 10 or 15 colleges, or even a majority of those, to change this practice, it would have, again, a tremendous effect of example. And the ones who still had to rely on coddling their alumni, that could be a way for others to sort of point down to them, yes, they still need to do that, but we don't need to do that. We are a meritocratic, fair play institution.
That shudder you hear is probably from development officers everywhere across the country going, ew.
Well, it's easy for me to say. I don't have to raise money for college.
James Fellows is the national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C. Mr. Fellows, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure.
And that interview by Karen Grigsby Bates. This is Day to Day from NPR News.